Freedom of speech is one of our most cherished freedoms and one of our most misunderstood.
Students don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, an expert in media law talks about the First Amendment's long reach and its limits. We'll also talk to a Northeast college president about spending another spring with COVID and spend an academic minute with cognitive contact tracing. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Here in the age of digital communication, social upheaval, and political division, the issues surrounding the First Amendment rights are more complicated and controversial than ever. A lot of people are using those free speech rights to argue about free speech without really understanding free speech. It's an issue that Ian Rosenberg hopes to clarify in his new book, The Fight for Free Speech, 10 Cases That Define Our First Amendment Freedoms. Ian Rosenberg is a media lawyer for ABC News and teaches media law at Brooklyn College. I asked him why this was the time to tackle free speech.
Well, I think if the last 4 years have taught us anything, it's that people on all sides of the political spectrum are demanding their right to speak and be heard. And while people are clamoring to declare their free speech rights, they really have nowhere to turn for understandable guidance about what those rights entail. So I wrote The Fight for Free Speech as a user's guide understanding our contemporary free speech questions. Each chapter begins with a pressing free speech controversy, you know, really ripped from the headlines, from, you know, Colin Kaepernick taking a knee to National School Walkout Day to Nazis marching in Charlottesville, and then focuses on the key Supreme Court case that answers the questions raised by that controversy. And I really do believe that if you read this book, you're going to get a crash course in understanding your free speech and free press rights and learn some engaging stories about the people who fought for their rights along the way.
It's so interesting you answer that question that way, because the second question I have written down here is, do people actually understand what freedom of speech means?
Right. And I think, you know, that I've been a media lawyer for 20 years, and I teach media law to graduate students in communications. And I really, surveying the field, there's very little out there that helps, you know, smart non-lawyers understand their rights. You know, there are textbooks that are for law students, and then there are a lot of opinionated books where people say, this is my take on the First Amendment. But The Fight for Free Speech is something different. It is this user's guide to understanding our rights. And, you know, my whole career as a media lawyer and a teacher has been explaining free speech and free press concepts to smart people who aren't lawyers. And so I really feel like I'm in a unique position to be able to talk about these issues in an engaging way that's really clear and doesn't sort of delve into a lot of theory or jargon.
You focus on 10 cases in the book, and I mean, that's a nice round number. Were you looking for 10? Could have you gone to 30 if you really were ambitious?
Well, there certainly could be more. There's lots of great First Amendment stories. But one of the, you know, ideas behind this book is to sort of reject the concept that we are taught in law school, that the law is like this seamless web, that meaning that you have to sort of know every single thread and how they're woven together. Otherwise, your understanding is incomplete. So I do reject that academic model. I believe that the fight for free speech is like buying a rug from IKEA. It's not going to be a perfect tapestry, but it's going to cover what you need, and it's going to get to you a lot quicker and cheaper. So you don't have to go to law school. You don't need more than 10 cases. These 10 cases really distill our First Amendment rights down to their essence.
I was, of course, looking in the book for some education-related cases, and there are two really big ones there. I'd like you to talk about them a little bit. The first was the case for not having students be required to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, and that it took such a circular route to finally get where we are today. Talk about that original case.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. So I begin with talking about the Colin Kaepernick's Take a Knee and saying, although the Supreme Court has never addressed the national anthem, they have directly talked about the right not to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And the case involves two elementary school sisters, the Barnett sisters, who refused to pledge allegiance to the flag because they were Jehovah's Witnesses and believed it was a form of idolatry that violated their religion. And this is during World War II. And the case winds itself with many interesting twists and turns all the way up to the Supreme Court. And for the first time, Justice Jackson says that there is a right not to speak. In other words, the First Amendment prohibits the government from forcing individuals to speak a message or to have the government force them to speak a message that they don't agree with. And he has some beautiful language that there's no principle more fixed in our constitutional constellation than the idea that nothing should be orthodox in politics. In other words, there's no one right way to speak or believe. And so people should have the freedom to not speak when they so choose. And that was the first time that right had been recognized. And while that doesn't necessarily apply to Colin Kaepernick from a legal perspective, because the NFL is a private employer, it does apply to students at public universities or even public high schools and elementary schools, because those student athletes also have a right, thanks to the Barnett sisters from World War II, to not speak a message they don't agree with.
And didn't that Supreme Court ruling reverse a ruling from just a few years prior?
That's right. So the Gobitis case involved a few years before that, just 3 years before that, there had been a different group of Jehovah's Witness students who had refused to pledge allegiance to the flag. And this was just at the beginning of World War II, where France was just about to be occupied. And Justice Frankfurter, who you might expect from history to be a liberal, he had been one of the co-founders of the ACLU, he says that patriotism is more important, that unity is more important than individual expression. And then that case is overturned by the Barnett case just 3 years later. So one of the things I try and weave into the book is understanding how constitutional law really works at the Supreme Court, always focusing on the First Amendment. But we will talk about how, you know, cases do get overturned and the sort of messy process of evolving liberty.
The other case I was hoping you'd tell us about was the Tinker case, where student speech was directly being argued at the Supreme Court.
Yes. So Tinker, I focus on Mary Beth Tinker, who was a middle school student at the beginning of the Vietnam War in Iowa, when the war was still popular with most Americans. And she, as a protest, wore a black armband to school, saying that she wanted to honor the dead on both sides, both Americans and Vietnamese, which is a very radical statement at its time. And she and her brother and another friend all wore these black armbands. They were sent home. They were threatened with expulsion. And their case goes up to the Supreme Court. And for the first time, Justice Fortas says that students don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gates, that you don't lose your free speech rights at the schoolhouse gates in class, as long as there is no reasonably foreseeable significant disruption, you have a right to nonviolent, silent protest during the school day. And while that, the contemporary question I discuss is, you know, does that mean you can walk out during, could students walk out during National School Walkout Day to protest gun violence? The answer is no, but those students can't be punished more strongly for protesting than they could if they skip school to go to the mall. So once again, I try and talk about the rights from our history and then what that means today.
You talk about an awful lot of different people in this book, and you cover a lot of cases. Was there any one person's story in there that just really stands out to you?
Yeah, you know, I even being somewhat knowledgeable at these topics, you know, in law school, you learn the law, but you don't really learn the stories behind the law. You don't hear who are the participants and what their lives were like. And that was one of the most fascinating things for me to discover in more detail, particularly, I think, Molly Abrams. It's in chapter one. She comes to this country at 16 as an immigrant Jewish woman fleeing pogroms and anti-Semitic violence in Russia. She becomes a seamstress on the Lower East Side, and we often glamorize sort of the immigrant life. It was very hard, and supporting her family, she became radicalized, became an anarchist who opposed World War I. She and some of her fellow compatriots, one of them named Jacob Abrams, printed two leaflets, in one in Yiddish and one in English, opposing World War I and specifically the U.S. involvement and incursion into the then revolution that was going on in Russia. And she literally scatters these leaflets from the rooftops of the Lower East Side, throwing them out a factory window. They caused a sensation. They were arrested, put in jail, sentenced to 20 years for the men and 15 years for Molly. And the case goes up to the Supreme Court. And the court, disturbingly but not surprisingly, upholds their conviction, says that you can go to jail for 20 years for criticizing the government for then advocating for illegal action. But Justice Holmes, in his dissent, joined by Justice Brandeis, revolutionizes our free speech law by creating the marketplace of ideas concept and saying that the best test of truth is its power to get accepted in the marketplace, and that these people's radical notions should be one element of the raucous debate that's going on in the marketplace, and that the government shouldn't interfere. It didn't help Molly. She ended up being deported to Russia. And as she left from a Brooklyn pier, she says to the people who had gathered to say goodbye to her, "I hope that our free speech rights are freer someday in this country in the future." She never returned to America, never was allowed to. But, you know, because of her, we really have the rights to criticize the government and the sort of fulsome understanding of a marketplace of ideas and a very pro-free speech, pro-dissent model in our country, thanks to her.
Does it seem like every generation or so we need a case that kind of reminds people that, yes, unpopular speech, as unpopular as it may be, is still legal?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for this generation, I believe it's Colin Kaepernick's Take a Knee protest. And one of the things that I think are so interesting is how that, you know, started out so much more controversially with, you know, Trump and others attacking Kaepernick's patriotism. And then in the wake of the death of George Floyd and the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, we have the NFL, you know, issuing a quasi-apology, still not really naming Kaepernick. And there's a real remarkable turnaround just in the last few years. I think that sometimes a protest in the past has a real rosy era of inevitability. But one of the things I bring up in the book is how unpopular even Dr. King was at the time of his death and at the time of the March on Washington, how most Americans opposed the March on Washington. So when people attack people's protests and say, like, you must be wrong, and in part because you're so unpopular, so many of us agree, we need to take a step back and remember that protest is almost always unpopular when it happens.
Well, we've been arguing about this amendment for over almost 250 years. 250 years from now, probably be doing the same thing.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I say at the end of my book is that just because I focus on Supreme Court cases, because it's a nice, clear way to say what the actual law is today and to tell one engaging story, free speech and advocating for free speech really happens as a grassroots activity far from the Supreme Court every day.
And again, the name of Ian Rosenberg's new book is The Fight for Free Speech, 10 Cases That Define Our First Amendment Freedoms. Still to come, a college president talks about keeping his campus community safe and thriving during the pandemic. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast, or download the WAMC Radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Union College, a private school in Schenectady, New York, had to close down for a few weeks this winter because of an outbreak of COVID-19 cases. That shutdown ended in early February, and college president David Harris plans to keep it that way. The Best of Our Knowledge's Ian Pickus spoke with Dr. Harris about how the college continues to cope with the pandemic.
So first of all, it wasn't imposed by the governor or anyone else. I just looked at the data and said, we need to do something different because we're in a pattern here that's not sustainable. So what we did was to say, first of all, we're going to continue to have classes in person. That was important because what we're learning is classes are about the safest place you can be on campus. Everything's controlled. People are using PPE, distancing, and so forth. So it didn't interrupt classes for students. What it did was to say, you can't leave campus. And we're limiting your interactions and informal interactions on campus. So it was more disruptive on the general life of school than it was on their academics.
How do you oversee something like that? How are you making sure, you know, the classes are safe, but once students aren't in classes anymore, how do you make sure they're doing the right thing?
You can't, 100%, of course, right? Unless you hired, you know, dozens and dozens of staff and hundreds to follow everybody around, which is not a world we want to live in. So it's really about helping our community understand what we need to do and why and what part they play. And I'm proud to say that the vast majority of students, faculty, and staff are doing the right thing when nobody's watching. They want to be here. They know what it takes. They're doing it. And when people aren't, it's the students who are telling us, hey, you should know, such and such is planning a party or such and such is doing a whatever it is, because they care that much about being here.
Why do you think Union is having a different experience this winter than it did last fall?
Yeah, so one of the things I've been saying to others in higher ed is you just have to keep in mind the context has changed. The jacket I was wearing in September did a great job. That jacket wasn't so good last week, right? Still a nice jacket, but, you know, the conditions have changed. And so what we're seeing is if you look at the charts, the number of COVID cases, the positivity rates, they're just, you know, in some cases 10 times higher than they were at parts of the fall. And so you can't have the same protection now that you had in the fall, just like that coat from the fall is not the same protection for February.
So what's the internal threshold, if you'll tell me, where you'll go back to a pause? I mean, is there a number that you look at and that's the danger zone, or how are you judging that?
Yeah, so it's funny. People ask me this all the time. So what's the trigger? What's the magic number that tells us we do something? And there isn't one. I'll tell you some of the things we look at. We look at the positivity rate, 7-day positivity rate, how much virus is out there that people could be exposed to. We look at the 7-day positivity rate at Union, how much virus is in here moving around that people would be exposed to. We look at our quarantine and isolation space, the space we have to put people who've tested positive or who are close contact. But then there are other issues. So for example, when I hear about a positive case and I'm alerted to the cases, one of the first questions is, do we know where they got it? So if it turns out that you have a lot of positives, but they're amongst people who were in quarantine because they were a contact of a known positive, that's not that troubling. But you could have half as many positives and say, we have no idea. They're just people who were in the community who hadn't been a close contact. We don't know where they're getting it. That's much more troubling. So that gives you a sense of why it's not as mechanical as, you know, if we have X cases, we send everybody home or such thing.
Did you ever think as a college president you'd have to be thinking about these kind of logistical issues, where a virus is, who has it, who's sent off to quarantine for 2 weeks, how that impacts who's going to classes? I mean, did you ever think you'd have this logistical challenge to deal with?
Nope. No, this is really not what you think you're going to be doing. I mean, I'll give you the most extreme version of this. So I'm a sociologist and demographer by training. That's what I was doing before I was pulled into administration. I look at mortality tables, right? Looking at, or in, all over the summer, I'm looking as a demographer would to say, and we're talking to experts, but trying to get a sense of, you know, what's the probability of infection in different age groups? What's the probability of serious illness or death and so forth? That's the kind of thing I thought I'd be doing as an academic. It's not the kind of thing that I thought as a college president I would be thinking about, but, you know, play with the hand you're dealt, and that's the hand we all have right now is COVID.
So is that teaching you anything about your own discipline? I mean, what are you learning from this experience?
Well, one of the things that I've said since question, probably at least since grad school, is that I think as a society, we often focus too much on the science, and we forget that when it comes to human issues, there's both the science, then there's the people and the interaction between the two, which, by the way, of course, is something we focus on at Union, which has engineering, computer science, and liberal arts. But look at it with the vaccine. It's amazing that we were able to come up with a vaccine as quickly as we did and have it be as effective as it is. But we have a problem with take-up rates. We have a problem with distribution. That's not biology. That's economics. That's psychology. That's sociology and other disciplines. So I think it's making the point even more strongly. We've got to think more holistically, not just the science. They're both essential.
So you wrote this op-ed for Inside Higher Ed. Reading it, you know, it seemed kind of stark in places. You know, you were saying, don't assume that everything you put in place last semester is going to work again this time around. What is some of the advice that you have for other campuses that we haven't talked about yet?
So I think we had 18 isolation rooms. So isolation is for people who've tested positive. And I remember saying to my team, well, I can't imagine that we'd be open if we had more than 18 positives. And I mean, yeah, it'd be hard to believe we'd still be open. Now we're saying, well, of course 18 wouldn't make everybody go home, and that wouldn't even be the best plan. In fact, we see a situation in which this term we've had 89 student positives and 23 faculty and staff positives. And so if you're going to open, you've got to be ready for far more than you experienced in the fall. It's not just what you do in terms of testing, what you do in terms of quarantines and isolating people at the beginning before the term starts. It's also just, are you ready with things like beds, but also just, are you ready psychologically? It's a lot to be leading these units and to be faculty, staff, students in these environments. And, you know, is your campus ready for this?
Well, what do you think? I mean, the fall semester, we saw many campuses close down, you know, pause for a month, send the kids home early for remote instruction. Are we about to, as a country, see a repeat of that this spring, you think?
I don't know. I think I like to think that we're more prepared. I mean, if you think about it, this has been required innovation and creativity for everybody across the world. But I would argue residential colleges and universities have had to pivot more than most. It's so fundamentally different to either teach remotely when you had a residential model, and in some cases like Union for 226 years a residential model, but it's also really hard when you say, okay, not only are they here learning, they live here. So we've got to figure out all those aspects. And so I like to believe, I think we did a good job as higher ed through 2020, and I like to think that we're going to be much more prepared to handle it as a sector in 21.
How much of a concern is the vaccine for you? Because clearly, supply is a problem. You know, people age 75 and up mm-hmm. are having a hard time getting it. So it's going to be weeks and weeks and weeks before we can even think about vaccinating young people who are in college. How does that factor into your planning?
So I will say that the New York State faculty who are teaching face-to-face are eligible to be vaccinated, and that's fantastic. Our faculty are on our lists. We're seeing them every day commenting on, you know, where are they able to sign up and what the waits are and so forth. So that's great to see. But you're right. It's going to be a long time before everyone in our community, faculty, staff, and students, are eligible for vaccination. And so that just means we've got to keep in mind that this is not a two-week project. This is something that's going to be with us almost certainly throughout the rest of this academic year. Hopefully no more, but certainly the rest of the academic year.
So if you had to guess, would you think back to college as we knew it in the before times at that point?
I'll tell you, it's a conversation we're having with a lot of other higher ed leaders right now, is because we start planning now for study abroad in the fall, our course schedules, all sorts of things are planning now. And what we're doing and what everyone else I talk to is doing is we're assuming a return to more normal in the fall, that we can engage in all those activities. But we know, right, that that's not assured. So we have to have plans in the back of our minds to pivot if need be. But right now, everyone that I've talked to is expecting to be back fully residential in the fall. And one of the other pieces I talk about in the op-ed, and I've been talking about on campus, is if at Union and across higher ed, all we do this academic year is survive COVID, we're able to stay open, people are able to continue to be here, that that's necessary but not sufficient for a successful year. So what we talk about all the time is we have to make sure that while with one eye, we've got one eye on COVID, that other eye has got to be on our strategic plan. It's got to be on why people are here and what they're trying to achieve. And as difficult as it is to do, we've got to do both of those at the same time. I feel like we've been successful, but it's challenging because there's so much energy just on COVID that you can easily let slip. And what you'd be doing is saying, that student who's here, only here for 4 years, one of their years will not be a year in which they pursue their core mission and pursue their goals. We're focused on both of those.
David Harris is the president of Union College in Schenectady, New York. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Ian Pickus. Contact tracing relies a lot on a COVID-19 patient's memory, but can it go deeper than that? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Do you remember everyone you interacted with in the past few days? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jacqueline Evans, associate professor of psychology at Florida International University, discusses memory and contact tracing during COVID-19.
Imagine being asked to name all 50 states. Even if you know them all, you'll still probably forget a few. But forgetting a state doesn't mean it's not in your memory. Memory isn't often talked about when it comes to fighting the COVID-19 pandemic, but it's one of the most useful, immediate, and widely accessible tools we have to slow the spread of the virus. Specifically, effective contact tracing relies on remembering all the people you had close contact with while infectious. But just like with the 50 states, it's easy to forget a few. My colleagues and I have been studying ways to improve contact tracing by taking advantage of how memory works. One technique that informed our work is the cognitive interview. Developed in part by FIU psychologist Ronald Fisher, the cognitive interview applies principles of psychology to investigative interviews, and it's effective for both person-to-person and self-administered interviews. Knowing this, and aware that many public health agencies are overwhelmed right now despite their valiant efforts, my colleagues and I created CogTracer, an online, private, do-it-yourself contact tracing interview tool. CogTracer guides you through a contact tracing interview, providing prompts to spark memories. For example, users are invited to mentally relive an experience by closing their eyes and visualizing themselves at a specific time and place. CogTracer also provides clue words like babysitter or exercise to cue people to think about activities and people they may not easily recall. This approach to contact tracing is not limited to COVID-19. It can be employed for other infectious diseases like Ebola, or yes, even in a future pandemic.
That was Jacqueline Evans of Florida International University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org and find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. ¶¶